Music and ideas here on KBCS 91.3, turning our attention to cultural competency today. Schools are a hot topic throughout the nation as resources for schools dwindle and conversations around standardizing testing continues. Today we talk about cultural competencies in school. According to a 2012 research, 50 state report of the Foundation for Public Education, 74% of Caucasian males graduate high school in our state today. That's in Washington State, 74%. In contrast, 55% of black males and 56% of Latino males graduate from high schools in Washington State. Now, we're going to talk about why this gap is a growing concern in our schools and what we may be able to do as community members, parents, administrators, and teachers to help all of our children do their best in school. Have two guests joining me in the studio today. Very happy to see their wonderful, beautiful, smiling faces. A mother of a high school age son, Cynthia Davis Van Loo. She's in the studio. Welcome to the studio, Cynthia.
Thank you.
And also with us is Seattle Central Community College faculty member, education activist, and consultant and coach in early childhood education, Fran Davison. Welcome to the studio, Fran.
Thank you.
And also joining us by phone from Los Angeles is UCLA Education and Information Studies professor, Dr. Tyrone Howard. Howard is also the author of the book, Why Race and Culture Matter in Schools, Closing the Achievement Gap. Hello, Dr. Howard, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Howard. How extreme is the achievement gap? I gave some pretty stark numbers there. 74% of Caucasian males in Washington State graduate versus 55 and 56% for black and Latino males. So how extreme is the achievement gap?
I wish I could say there was good news I could bring on this front, but it's really depressing on a number of levels, and you've touched on one of them with regard to graduation rates, and we can look at a number of other areas, discipline rates, levels of students who have access to high honors and AP courses. When we look at issues around who gets access to gifted and talented education courses, the gap unfortunately exists on a lot of different levels, and it's been stubborn by and large for the past two decades. So the fact that we're talking about this within the context of cultural competence, I think, is not only necessary but long overdue in a lot of ways.
And let's talk about it in the context of cultural competency, because what role does that play in public schools and others?
Well, I think we have to be clear. Anytime we're talking about why these disparities exist, there's never a single explanation or a single answer that explains it. There are a multitude of factors that are at play here, and I definitely think that one of those factors is the cultural disconnect that we see in many of our schools between students who are currently in our schools and the very makeup of the teachers that they have. What we know, and there's all kind of data that bears this out, is that we continue to see an increasingly diverse group of students coming to our classrooms from different racial, ethnic, cultural, and linguistic backgrounds. But what we know they do is they come into contact with an increasingly homogeneous teaching population. Translation, more and more middle-class white women who are monolingual tend to come into contact with students of color who speak various languages and who also tend to come from lower-income backgrounds. So that raises a number of cultural disconnects that can occur where I don't think you have teachers who are not well-intentioned. I think there's just a lot of cultural ignorance that exists that leads to a lot of missed opportunities for learning.
And talk about some of those missed opportunities and how we can turn those opportunities around, I guess, so that we're not missing them and that we can incorporate some of that understanding. Because as you said, it's not ill-advised. It's well-intentioned, but it exists.
Yes, it exists. So part of it is what we need to start off with is understanding that culture is a complex, multifaceted phenomenon that shapes how we think, how we communicate, how we learn, how we process, how we engage, how we interact. And part of what we see happening in schools is that many teachers have a very surface level of culture, surface from the standpoint of thinking and from the standpoint of only foods, festivals, and holidays, which are definitely some aspects of culture, but that's not deep-seated kinds of culture. So what we have are young people who enter classrooms.
Dr. Howard, I have to stop you for one second because I need you to go back to that one statement about the food culture. Please say that again. I think that is so, like, that's such a light. If no one hears nothing else, I'm like, wow, you summed it up right there. These are the cultural things we celebrate. Please go back to that just one more time.
Right. So I say the food festivals and holidays were in a lot of schools. The idea becomes we can show our cultural competence if we put pictures of Dr. King and Cesar Chavez on the wall during Black History or during Cesar Chavez's birthday. And therefore, we thought we've done something that really makes children of color feel recognized or included. Or we have an assembly where we have a group that has a particular tribal or ethnic dance. And again, I don't want to diminish those efforts, but I don't think they get to the real deep level aspect of culture where we talk about how young people learn. So that's where I think we need to go.
Well, talk about some of your recommendations. What do you recommend be done to help the current situation and improve that competency piece? Because as you said, I just like the food festivals and holidays, because I think that is really a good summation. But I would, but definitely, as you said, not to diminish those efforts, but it does go beyond that surface level.
Absolutely. So first, I think it starts with teachers coming to grips with their own degrees of privilege, with their own degrees of recognizing how they, many times teachers, not all, but many teachers operate from the standpoint that their experiences are the only experiences that exist. So the ways that they communicate or how they express their thoughts and feelings and desires within the context of learning are oftentimes very much at odds with where our students come from. So I think it requires teachers to examine their own ideology, examine their own ways of communicating, and to be very upfront about some of their own intentional and implicit bias that they may have towards particular students, namely poor students, namely students of color. And that's why we see, I think, gross disproportionality with regards to discipline. We have all kinds of data that shows that students of color, namely African-American and Latino students, are oftentimes disciplined for behavior that's very similar to what white students oftentimes exhibit, but oftentimes the ways in which young black children, young Latino children tend to express themselves or articulate what they know is just not in the same cultural frame of reference that their teachers might be in. So part of it is for our teachers to listen, to learn, and to understand that there are multiple ways of expressing, multiple ways of communicating, multiple ways of learning and processing, and being sensitive to a broader range of ways in which people experience learning, in which they experience teaching, and how they experience themselves in that process.
Well, Fran, I saw you doing a lot of head shaking during this, as Dr. Howard was talking. So I'm actually going to come to you because I wanted to, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that head shaking. What were you hearing that was resonating with you as an education activist and obviously someone who's been doing this work for a very long time?
Well, I think right away I am concerned about the fact that 80% of teachers of children of color will be white middle class women who, as Dr. Howard inferred, within their culture, privilege is embedded, and it's unexamined privilege. And they have received teacher preparation in various locations where culture and racism and social injustice aren't even part of the curriculum, or they're an add-on class. And that's fairly typical, I think. And so how are white middle-class women being prepared if they haven't ever talked about these issues before? And there's so much denial that this is significant. There is so much denial. And yet we have tons and tons of research that say children start learning about race and racism shortly after they're born. I mean, we don't have to keep debating this. So why don't white folks know this?
Well, I mean, I know you only speak for one, which is yourself, but what would you say? Why do you think that understanding is not there among white people? Or, why do you think that exists in that way?
Well, racism and white privilege serve a purpose, and that purpose is well disguised with information like we all have, it's a level playing field, or we all have bootstraps and all sorts of. And so if you say, well, how come these white males are graduating at a higher rate than African-American and Latino males? Mm-hmm. And you say, well, they haven't worked hard enough. But yeah, they have. They have worked hard enough, and therefore, what you're implying is racism. You're saying that race is the difference.
That's a big statement, and that's, yeah. And especially I know, I mean, as a Caucasian woman working in this field, how did you get in this field, and you're so passionate about it, which I think is beautiful and I appreciate. How did you decide that this was something you wanted to explore and be a part of the solution?
Well, I won't tell you the whole story. It's many chapters long, but it did start in my own growing up years and seeing how my family treated people of color differently, and certainly redlined them out of the neighborhood, out of the schools, out of everything. And because of a particular incident, which I'm not going to talk about now, I would at another time.
Then that means I have to invite you back?
That's right.
Okay.
It's all about unfairness and inequity. It is not about equality. There is only democracy for a few in this country, and I think we have to face up to that.
Mm. Well, I'm going to definitely come back to you, but I want to turn my attention to Cynthia. As a mother, you have a high school age son. You're African American. So talk about some of your own experiences with cultural competency, whether it's through your son's high school experience or through your own.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about a particular experience with my son, and this was back when he was in kindergarten, so just starting out, 5 years old, and it still affects me strongly because it was such a big
that. Oh my goodness, and you're talking
such
about
a big
it.
Experience.
You're already welling up,
and Dr. Howard's mentioning about discipline and the different disciplinary practices. So my child was in kindergarten. And he went to a public school that was primarily children of color, African-American, and immigrant and refugee community, so English language learners. And he had this one little friend who was around a lot of older kids, another kindergartner, who told my very trusting child to put up his middle finger and go ask the teacher what that meant. So my child did just that, because we taught him that, you know, especially in the education environment, when you want to learn something, you ask the teacher. You ask the adults around you. That's something that you can do. So that's what he did. And this wasn't one of his teachers, but it was another teacher. It was on the playground. And so he went up to this teacher, and a young white teacher, he was a student teacher at the time. But at any rate, he asked this teacher what that meant. He showed him his middle finger and says, "What does that mean?" And the teacher's response was to say, "You know what that means. Go sit in the disciplinary circle." Mm. And my child was somebody who was quiet, had never gotten into trouble, and he wanted to know what this meant. And he knew that he got in trouble, and it hurt him so deeply that he cried for the rest of the day. And then when I went to pick him up, and his teacher told me what happened, and she was like, "I tried to console him, but he didn't know what it meant." And, you know, there was no consoling him. And he went to bed that night. He says, "Mom, I know it's a bad word, but I still don't know what it means." And
so he just had a healthy curiosity. He really just had a question that was just pure curiosity. But
yes,
that curiosity was immediately responded with a, "Oh, you know, go away.
You know what,
you
that,
know
means.
What that means."
And for somebody to assume
an assumption, yeah, I was gonna say, a big
that
assumption
a five-year-old
would know
knows
what that means.
What that means is, especially because, you know, we're in a school that's primarily children of color. A good percentage were lower income English language learners. And, you know, when people are learning new languages, they want to know the prohibited words first. And that's what they learn from their friends. And so the assumption that even if the kids are using that language or using those signs, that they know what it means was that was, you know, a sign that an indication that that was a racial assumption.
Oh, absolutely. That was an assumption about how he was raised and the kind of environment that he might be around, that he would know that kind of sign and symbol. Well, do you feel like schools have made efforts in terms of cultural competency to, as you've watched your child go through the public school system? I mean, this happened when he was 5 years old. So you don't have to take us through the whole thing, but now he is in high school. So what has been, or has there been any difference between now and then?
There is a difference. And even in that incident, the school had a diversity committee, a faculty diversity committee. And one person on that committee asked me if I had any experiences that I would like to share and for him to share with the diversity committee. And I did. And I told him about that experience. And you know, I don't know that it went anywhere. I didn't get any feedback about it. But even the efforts that the teachers are trying to make, even if there are some teachers who know what cultural competency is and they have some training and they want to share that and they want to have the conversations that include talking about racism, because in this country you can't talk about cultural competency without talking about racism. There is a shutdown, whether it's in the system itself or with other parents, especially white middle-class parents, who aren't comfortable with that kind of conversation going on. It's something that prevents cultural competency from growing and moving and really being effective in the classrooms and in the school system.
Well, you're obviously an involved mom, which is beautiful. So what would you say to other parents? What are some things they can do when faced with cultural incompetency in schools?
I think, it's really hard because I like the idea of letting the principal, letting the teachers know what it is and what your perspective is and what your position is on what happens. But, you know, at the same time, you have to take care of your child. And it's hard to do both all the time because it takes a lot of energy to really have that conversation, to try to have an honest conversation about race and class and incompetency. When you're also trying to heal your child's experience. Mm. So I don't know.
Sometimes you have to make a choice between being the parent and/or being the, you know, parent, the active parent involved with the school. Like sometimes it sounds like it's a little bit of a balancing act.
Right.
I mean, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Well, Fran, I would ask you the same question. What advice would you give to parents, though, in terms of how they can get involved, on that level of understanding cultural competency in schools and if it does impact their kids?
Well, I just wanted to pick up on, if you don't mind, and then
absolutely
steer me back,
and go back.
To what Cynthia said, because this is a huge, she's giving white folks, many white folks that are listening, a huge gift, and that is white parents will often say, well, you just better go see the principal and you just better do this and you just better, knowing full well because of their privileged position and because of white supremacy, nothing's going to happen to their kid. In fact, their kid is going to get, oh, Mrs. So-and-so's onto this, better be careful because she knows and she knows. Whereas what Cynthia is saying, oh, the repercussions could be deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, I was recently, well, the White Privilege Conference was here in town a few weeks ago, and I attended a lecture put on by African-American teachers who were saying, why don't more African-American young folks go into the teaching profession? And there was, but the racism and the fact that you'll probably be in a school where you'll be the only person of color, and when they expanded upon and the audience really participated hugely, was the racism in the lunchroom, in the teacher's lunchroom. You, as a person of color, you cannot go into that lunchroom because you will hear kids of color being systematically torn apart. And several, I have absolutely no reason to disbelieve any of the stories I heard.
And that's a hard position for teachers to be. I mean, I have several friends who are educators that exactly what you just said, because then they have to make a decision about how many of those kids can they stand up for? How many of those conversations can they actually step in and try to help? Because they're also, it's their job, it's their coworkers. I mean, they're in a very precarious position as well. Yes. Well, Dr. Howard, I wanted to get you to chime in here as well. We're running out of time, but I wanted you to give some advice, not only to parents, but I guess, you know, community even, you know, what are some things that the community and, you know, parents specifically, you know, could do? What are some solutions or suggestions you might have?
I just want to really give an amen to so much of what both Cynthia and Fran have said. I think it's important for parents and community members to get engaged, to talk to their children. Young people are very brilliant. As young as 5, 6 years old, they can tell us what they experience and they can tell us what they feel. I think when our young people tell us what they're experiencing in schools, I think it's important for us to come and talk to principals, talk to teachers, talk to school officials, and share our concerns with how our young people are feeling. For a lot of young children, what we know is that learning is a social process. And if you don't feel trusted, if you don't feel safe, if you don't feel welcome in those spaces, learning is going to suffer as a result of that. One of the things I typically do, I think Cynthia hit it right on the head when she said you can't talk about cultural competence without talking about racism. And unfortunately, many whites in this country don't want to talk about racism. When I do workshops with white teachers, I like them to just be in that space of discomfort around racism, because for me, I want them to understand if it's for 5 minutes, if it's for 10 minutes, how uncomfortable that feeling is for them, for whatever reason. And then I try to say, how do you think young children of color feel to sit in classrooms day in, day out, week in, week out, and to feel uncomfortable because they've been invalidated or they've been disciplined or they've been looked at in a different way? So somehow, some way, we've got to get our white teachers and other teachers across the board, but primarily our white teachers, to understand what that exclusion feels like, what that discomfort feels like. And usually at that point, when people can begin to understand and feel what that pain is like, or to feel what that hurt or exclusion looks like, they can start to move and think about their own practice a little bit better. But I think we have to begin to collect data. I think we have to look at numbers. I think we have to look at the fact that we have this federal probe in Seattle, as everyone knows, that looks at discipline disparities there across race.
Thank you for touching on that. I wanted to touch on that, and we're out of time, but I'm glad you put that out there. Yes, thank you.
And I think it goes beyond that. I think it comes down to our staffing, and I think it comes down to the composition of our parent-teacher staff association groups, our professional development. There's got to be an institutionalized framework that we begin to have a school community and culture that is reflective of the communities that our children live in and reflective of the community that their parents work in. So I think we cannot let these issues die. We have to continue to raise them. We have to continue to say, you know what, if our children are saying this is what they're experiencing, and we see that there are countless other children who are raising these same questions, that is enough data to say we have to investigate and raise some questions and say we want some different kinds of outcomes in terms of what our children are experiencing in schools.
Well, Dr. Tyrone Howard, I thank you very much. UCLA professor and author of Why Race and Culture Matter in Schools, Closing the Achievement Gap. Thank you so much for joining us via phone in California. Thank you, Fran Davidson, for being here, education activist and consultant and coach in early childhood education. Cynthia Mom, obviously an education activist as well. Thank you very much for being here. You can find resources to all of our guests on our website at kbcs.fm. You can also find this interview archived. Please click on it and share it with your friends. Thank you all for your time.